Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. When you're about to have elective or any non-emergency surgery, you may be quite selective in the surgeon you use, including getting a second or third opinion about whether the surgery is even needed and who's the best person to do it. We want to be confident that the surgeon doing the operation is going to do the best possible job. We just assume that this is the person who will actually do the surgery. But those working on the inside of the OR and the inside of healthcare know that the surgeon may not do any or all of the surgery, may only do part of the surgery, if any. Today on Health Styles, we're going to talk about the questions that you should think about asking before signing that consent form and having the surgery. But we're going to start by talking with an insider who questioned a surgeon about who would do the surgery and the fallout she experienced just from asking that question. And that insider is Dr. Nancy Short. She's a registered nurse and associate professor at Duke University School of Nursing and a former Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow. And I want to bring that in because she pays attention to what goes on in healthcare and the related policy issues. And she's also got 20 years of experience in clinical practice beyond the work that she's done in health policy and academia. So, Nancy Short, thank you so much for being with me today.
And thank you for inviting me, Diana. It's a pleasure.
So, Nancy, most people assume that the surgeon they're talking with preoperatively, you sit down for that pre-op visit, and you assume that that's a person who's going to do the surgery. You have been on the inside of healthcare and for a number of years here. What did you understand the situation to be as a nurse who has been working in intensive care units and emergency rooms for over 20 years? Before you became a patient, what did you understand the situation to be about who does the surgery?
Well, before 2007 or 2008, when I was kind of awakened to a piece of policy as established by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, I was under the same impression that I think most Americans are, that you select a surgeon and you sign an informed consent and that that surgeon conducts your surgery, performing it, and generally stays in the OR with you through the entire surgery. Well, my background is in large academic health centers, of course. Duke is a very large academic health center. And so I've been aware that there are learners in the operating room, such as resident physicians or higher level fellows who might be surgical residents, and that they would assist. But my understanding of assisting was that they would perhaps hold retractors, help with some of the snipping or cauterizing while the attending physician, the surgeon that you had selected, did all or most of the surgery, and that they might do closure. So that was my understanding prior to what I would call an awakening.
So tell us about your awakening.
Well, through contact with primarily student registered nurse anesthetists who were in some of my courses at the master's program and the doctor of nursing practice programs at Duke, I became aware of stories that they were telling in discussion boards on our online courses. And some of these stories had to do with surgeons, attending physicians being absent from operating rooms. And it became more and more clear to me that there was a policy, an accepted practice, a tradition that surgeons could leave the operating room, not just for, say, an emergency bathroom break or to go help if something broke loose in another OR that was so serious that it required all hands on deck. But they could leave. They could actually schedule two or more surgeries that they were the primary surgeon, and that these surgeries were running simultaneously. And so that was my awakening.
So the surgeon may not even be in the room when you have your abdominal surgery.
That's correct. In 2008, I did have a personal experience with this information, and it was as a result of my colon, my lower bowel, being perforated during a routine hysterectomy. I'm a very healthy individual. I don't have a fragile colon or any reason for my colon to spontaneously perforate. And my colon was perforated by an ill-placed suture, a stitch. And no one has disputed that it was an ill-placed suture. Mm. And so I needed a bowel resection. And,
Which means what?
A bowel resection means that a few inches of the colon need to be removed. So where the tiny hole was in my colon, that section of the intestine, the colon is part of the intestine, would be surgically removed. And the remaining new ends that are now loose from each other have to be sewn together, or re-anastomosed is the word, and so that the colon is again intact. It does require extensive opening of the abdomen, and in my case, they had to really search for the little hole, and it's a big surgery. It's a 4 to 6 hour surgery, so it's not something to be entered in lightly. There was, in my case, a possibility that I would end up with a temporary or permanent colostomy, which is when the bowel is brought to the outside of the body on the abdominal wall, and you wear a bag to collect your excrement and feces, and that could have been temporary or for the rest of my life. So the small error with the misplaced stitch did have momentous results and impact in my life.
So tell us about the conversation you had with the surgeon.
Well, the bowel surgeon that I got involved with was recommended as an excellent technician who could perform the surgery. He did happen at that time to be the only bowel surgeon on the Duke staff. So I did not really select him. My insurance more or less selected him for me, and the fact that all of my surgeries had the previous surgery, the hysterectomy, had been at Duke, so I needed to follow up and stay at Duke. And in the course of signing the informed consent, I asked several questions, knowing what I knew from my students. And so one of the questions I asked was, will you be performing my entire surgery? I also asked, who will be assisting? I had learned from the hysterectomy to ask, what does assisting mean to you? Because to me, as I said earlier, it meant a few non-critical activities, such as helping the surgeon clip suture material or holding retractors. I also asked about infection rates, and I asked, will you remain in the OR at all times? So those were the questions that I asked, and I did not get the response that I really hoped for.
What response did you get?
Well, there was some hedging. There was obvious discomfort, as probably as shown mostly by body language. There was a lot of quiet kind of looking at me very strangely, like I had grown horns or something. My impression was that this surgeon was completely surprised, a little bit, if not a lot, annoyed, and didn't quite know what to do with me. The answer was essentially that assisting meant that the residents or surgical fellows in the OR would do whatever the surgeon wanted them to do, whatever was necessary, and that he would supervise. So, in other words, I didn't get a very in-depth or straight answer. Will you remain in the OR at all times? He answered that that was not something he could determine in advance. He would not be more specific than that. He did answer that the infection rate in general for this surgery was 30%, which I found to be alarming. So, you know, 3 in 10 people would have a post-operative infection. So in general, I then said to him, I would like to add, to write in on my consent form prior to signing that I consent, that I do not want any physician learners, whether they are medical students, interns, residents, or fellows, doing any cutting or burning of tissue, and that I want you to be present in the OR at all times. Well, I had really grown 3 heads at this point. And so he says to me, you can't put that on this form. You need to put that on the anesthesia consent. Hmm. Well, this at the time, I was very vulnerable. Hmm. I had a hole in my colon. Hmm. I was scared to death. Hmm. I thought, okay. Now, when I got away from the immediate anxiety of it all, but I had already signed the regular consent, I got to thinking, wait a minute. If I put down no learners on the anesthesia consent, it's really only applying to anesthesia. Hmm. It's not really applying to what the surgeon does. The consent I had just signed applied to what the surgeon would do. And I don't think most Americans have any clue what the difference is between the surgical consent and the anesthesia consent. Mm. So that, again, is of concern, that we're in a society that is telling us, consumer-directed health care is revolutionary, it's the new way to go, patient-centered, everything. And yet, when you try to take control of something, seriously, you have grown 3 heads. Shall I continue?
Yes, please do. Please do. What happened next?
Well, what happened next is, since I have a long, long history with Duke Medical Center, I've been a staff nurse there. I've been a nurse manager. I've been a specialist in employee relations, and I've been faculty there since 2003. I have 2 degrees from Duke University, and I know a lot of people there. Well, as dawning awareness grew, and I was concerned about that infection rate, I started sending out a few emails and making a few phone calls, I'd say maybe 5 or 6 total, and one of those was also to the surgeon who was going to do the surgery, and I said in my emails different things to different people depending on their rank in the organization. For instance, one buddy I just simply contacted to say, I'd really like you to arrange for me to be post-operatively on your unit. Okay, simple things. One person I contacted, I said, is it true that there's a 30% infection rate? Or is this just for the surgeon? And if this is a problem, what can I do to avoid it? What kind of quality improvement is in place? And lastly, with the surgeon, I said I was still uncomfortable and that I really wanted a guarantee that he would remain in the room the entire surgery, that I had come to accept that in an academic health center, it was necessary that learners have a large role in surgeries. So if he would just simply assure me that he would remain in the room. Well, days passed. And I went ahead to my pre-op appointment, had my blood drawn, had my EKG, those things that you do. I paid my little $350 copay as due from my insurance policy. And it was now 3 days prior to the bowel resection surgery. I'm awakened at 0800 one morning, and it's my surgeon, my primary, the main guy, and he's calling me saying that he has been in consultation with the medical director of the entire Duke Hospital and with some other leadership and risk management at Duke, and they have determined that I am to be dismissed as a patient, that he cannot do the surgery. And you may recall earlier I said at that time he was the only bowel surgeon on the staff. And so that effectively meant I could not have this surgery at my own institution where the original problem had occurred with the stitch in my colon. I, of course, started crying. I was devastated. I had a hole in my colon. I had feces coming out of the wrong place in my body. It was terrible. I had been almost a prisoner in my home because of this feces and gas coming out the wrong place for several months while we checked to see if it would heal naturally. And so I begged. I said, it doesn't have to be this way. I've signed the consent. I've not written anything in. I've paid my copay. It's 3 days away. What am I going to do? And the answer was, my secretary will send you a list of people you may want to consider. I strongly recommend that you find a community hospital where they don't have learners, and that you may be happier if you don't have learners in the OR. And with that, he got off the phone, and I was left with no hospital, no doctor, no referral, and an insurance policy that covers only Duke facilities for insurance. And I wept, and my husband sat beside me, and he's a tough man, and tears streamed down his cheek as well. I was terrified.
So, Nancy, why doesn't this qualify as patient abandonment?
I did not pursue it with the medical board. It may well qualify as patient abandonment, but I was concerned that if I went to the medical board with it, that first of all, my energy was all focused toward getting me back intact. And second, I understand that when a lone person tries to take on an institution that is large, frequently that person is made to look difficult or maybe even a depressed person or belligerent, all of those words that as nurses we have heard used to describe some patients. I'm sure you're familiar with it too, Diana, as a nurse. And I simply was so vulnerable, I couldn't conceive of putting myself at risk of being torn down, tried to make, you know, if someone trying to make me look like a bad patient and a bad person. I just couldn't bear the thought of it at that time. I was so vulnerable and so frightened and so fragile. I was scared that if it took very long to find another surgeon, that I might develop infections since I had feces coming out the wrong way. I was afraid that the feces might contaminate my urinary tract, and a high danger would be that my kidneys would end up being infected. I had a lot of fear. So I cannot tell you specifically if a medical board would view this as abandonment or not. I can tell you that my understanding of abandonment would be that the surgeon or attending, whoever did the abandoning, would get maybe a letter of reprimand. Mm. So, you know, what's the point?
So you had the surgery, though, at another hospital?
Yes. I used my extensive network of well-placed nurse colleagues. Mm-hmm. And a nurse colleague who is very dear to me made several phone calls, and she personally contacted a department head at the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And that department head worked with a bowel surgeon at that university academic health center, and he called me. He called me personally, and we had a chat. And I was very above board with him. I said, here's what's happened. I know that the world is small between bowel surgeons, that you probably all know each other. You probably all attend the same meetings. And I don't want you to run into somebody who says, oh, did you end up with her? Wasn't she difficult? So I told him the whole story, and he was wonderful. He said, I know exactly what you mean. I never leave my ORs. I never run more than one at once. Yes, my surgical residents and fellows do participate heavily in the surgery, and he gave me some examples. He said, but I supervise every cut, every cautery burn that they make, and every stitch that they take. And he went on and he assured me that for the most delicate part of my surgery, which would be sewing the two ends of the bowel back together. You don't want any holes left in that. Mm-hmm. That he personally would do that himself. And with that, my relationship with him was established, and he did perform the surgery, and there was a small post-operative infection that took 6 weeks to heal, but I had so much trust in him and confidence that I was very satisfied.
And you're doing well now.
I am doing very well now, yes.
So
I have a very large scar, but yes, I'm doing very well.
Good. So we're almost out of time, and I wanted, Nancy, for you to say just a few words about what do you recommend first that other people do who are in the similar situation if they're about to have surgery. Do you recommend people have this question, pose this question to their surgeon about who will do the surgery and speak about their concerns about others who might be in the room or not in the room, themselves, whether the surgeon's in the room, as well as what do we need to do to fix this problem overall? In probably 2 minutes.
Okay, I do recommend that people ask the same questions that I did. Will mm-hmm. you perform my entire surgery, and will you stay in the room? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you get an answer that you can't be happy with, you need to walk away and find another surgeon. Mm-hmm. In terms of fixing the problem, it is a problem at a high health policy level. Surgeons are allowed to run more than one OR at a time. I thought maybe it was a form of fraud. Reimbursement type
yes.
fraud, but it is not. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services do approve and do have in their state operations manuals that this is an approved policy that a surgeon has to be in the room for, quote, critical moments, but those critical moments are determined only by each individual surgeon.
And one other question. So the whole idea of learners in the room, if you go to an academic medical center, you have the medical students, the interns, the residents, and the fellows. So the surgeon who ended up doing your surgery actually did permit them to, or was going to permit them, to participate in the surgery, but with his supervision. Is that acceptable, do you believe?
It's acceptable, but I do believe that patients ought to be told this and the level of the extent at which those learners will participate. I believe it needs to be fully explored when the informed consent is being explained and signed. I think not to mention it, not to teach the patient about this if they don't know anything about hospital management and the way hospitals run, is a form of deception.
Mm-hmm.
And most Americans probably don't know to ask the questions. And by keeping quiet and not bringing it forward, saying learners will be in the room and these are the kinds of things they will be doing, I think it is a form of omission that is not ethical.
Well, Dr. Nancy Short, I want to thank you so much for coming on to Health Styles and sharing your story and raising the visibility of this issue that you never hear about anywhere. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity to share this problem. I do think that we need to have a remedy in the form of improved informed consent.
Dr. Nancy Short is an associate professor at Duke University School of Nursing and a former Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellow. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of Health Styles, and I want to thank you for listening today. This program, Health Styles, is brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thanks for tuning in to Health Styles. Ha 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 ha